The philosophy behind leadership is a fascinating topic. We have a true educational leader here today to talk about this issue. We're honored and privileged to have Dr. Marjorie Haas, president of Austin College in Sherman, Texas, here with us tonight. As many of you may not know, I didn't know this, Austin College is the oldest college operating in the state of Texas.
Yes.
Pretty amazing, out of Sherman, Texas. And guess who was one of its original board of trustees? It's formed in 1849.
Named after him by his sister.
Sam Houston. Yes. 1849. The big statue on I-45, right? So 1845, and it was the first college in Texas to grant a graduate degree. I thought it was UT Austin. Sherman College is preeminent when it comes to that.
Austin College.
Oh, nice. You need to take my place.
You're irreplaceable.
Austin College in Sherman, Texas. Dr. Haas began her role as president on July 1st, 2009, and is the first woman to serve as president of Liberal Arts College, which is affiliated with the Presbyterian Church. Prior to this appointment, she was provost of Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And her son is here, Cameron. He's a student at Muhlenberg. And her husband as well, Larry, is here. She began her career in Muhlenberg in 1993, teaching in the philosophy department. And she earned tenure in 1998 and promotion to full professor in 2006. She specializes in the philosophy of logic, the philosophy of language, and feminist philosophy, and earned her PhD in philosophy at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in 1993, and her BA and MA degrees at the same institution in the late 80s. The title of her speech is Rhetoric and Vision, How a Leader's Words Matter. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Marjorie Haas.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. We were very excited when we heard that there was such an entity as the Philosopher's Forum, and even more thrilled to be asked to come and address you. I have a lot of opportunities where I speak before groups. Usually, I'm asking them for money to support scholarships at the college, but I understand you've already paid your $4, so I will not be asking anyone for a penny. I couldn't resist, of course, the opportunity to just bring a few brochures and some information about Austin College. It really is a tremendous place. And if you've never been to the campus, I hope you will make an effort to come to Sherman. It's 55 minutes door-to-door from this restaurant to the front door of the college, so it's not a long drive. You see a lot of cows and shops on the way. Shops for about the first 45 minutes, and then cows after that. And we would love to have you visit the campus.
Is it still on Grand Avenue?
It still is on Grand Avenue. That is actually our address, yeah. And you can tell my house it's on Grand Avenue right across from the college with the big Austin College flag out front. We would just love to welcome you. It's really a tremendously special place, and we are excited to be there, excited to be Texans for the first time in our lives. So it's great to be welcome here. As you can imagine, becoming a college president, which I did on July 1st, you think a lot about leadership. You really think even more so. I certainly have held leadership roles before. I've been a dean, I've been a provost. But there's something about being the president of an institution, being the really public face of it, as well as the sort of internal guide to its direction, that really makes you think hard about leadership. Being a philosopher, of course, that means I think about philosophy and leadership. And so it really became sort of a passion for me to think about what is the relationship between the work that I was trained to do as a philosopher and the work that I am now paid to do as a college president? What is that relationship? Are they two totally separate pieces of my life and my work? Is there a natural progression? And there are a lot of connections there. We were talking about some of them over dinner. But one of the things that immediately became apparent to me was that both of these roles really require the sort of putting into language of very difficult ideas and concepts. When you're a college professor, particularly when you're teaching something as abstract as philosophy, or probably that's true about accounting also, you spend a lot of energy really trying to make very abstract, complicated ideas become alive for your students. And the same thing is true for me, certainly, as a college president, where I have to try and sum up and grasp the whole sense of a very complicated place and put that into words, both for internal constituents, to help them sort of see the direction that we want to head, and also external constituents to try and explain what we're about and to encourage engagement with the institution. So for me, this topic tonight is very, very personal. It's something I've been thinking about a lot lately, and I can't tell you how thrilled I am to have an opportunity to talk about an idea with all of you. So I will talk for a little bit, and I understand this is a very conversational group, so my talk is designed to invite conversation as well, and I look forward to that part of it. It's impossible to think about rhetoric and about the role that words and language and speech making play in leadership without thinking about Aristotle. At least for those of us in this room, it's impossible to think about that. And so, of course, we would look back towards Aristotle's very classic explanation of what rhetoric and language is about. And you'll probably remember, either from reading Aristotle or from something you learned in your composition class in college, if you're old enough to have had a composition class, they don't do that anymore. They do the freshman seminar instead. That Aristotle says that persuasion with language, rhetoric, the power of using words to make change, to lead, really has three parts to it. Ethos, pathos, and logos. If I had a chalkboard, that's what I'd write up there right now. Ethos, pathos, and logos. If you look at a modern textbook, though, on rhetoric, or you take a class in rhetoric, or you have one of those writing classes where they say we're going to sort of start with the basics, you'll find that those terms are usually defined now very simply. So the classic rhetoric book or class or textbook will tell you, okay, ethos is really the status of the speaker. So what kind of authority does the person have? If they are trying to persuade you of a particular view about a medical treatment, are they themselves a doctor or a researcher? If they're making a legal argument, are they trained in law? So typically we understand that piece, ethos, as the sort of status from where the person comes from. Pathos is emotion. Aristotle was very aware that one of the ways that we persuade or lead is through the use of emotion. And so pathos is usually understood as emotion. And logos is logic, the sort of actual reasons that you give and the structure of the argument. So ethos, pathos, and logic, and logos, Aristotle said, and those are usually understood in modern rhetoric textbooks as status, emotion, and logic. What I want to talk about tonight is how we might renew that framework. I think in my own thinking about this and experience, I was going to say Aristotle is right, but that sounds so presumptuous. Aristotle, of course, is right. Aristotle is right. But Aristotle, I think, has something there for us really to think about. But I think the way we have understood those terms in our contemporary framework is too narrow. I think we've emptied out the significance of those three things, and we've reduced them to these sort of very bland concepts so that we do understand ethos and all that we might think of that as bringing to a situation of leadership or persuasion as just this very narrow piece. So when I read those rhetoric textbooks and I try and understand how a leader is supposed to persuade, they would tell me, well, you're supposed to stand on the ground of your authority. You're supposed to stand up there and you're supposed to say, I'm the president of the college and I have these degrees and that's going to carry the weight of my argument. And then you are supposed to use pathos. So here is a poster of a wonderful young student from a poor family who will have to drop out of college if you don't cough up the money for the scholarship. And I am not above that, I will tell you. Absolutely. We can easily move to that part of the evening. And then I'm supposed to use logos, and I will give you the facts and the figures, and I'll show you our budget, and I will talk about why this is a good investment. And all of those obviously are important things, but they don't seem to me to really capture what we understand when we think of the very best rhetorical leaders. When you think of the ways in which a leader like Martin Luther King or Churchill, or I'll talk also a little bit about Lincoln, and we were talking a little bit about that before. When you think about the ways that they led with words, there seems to be so much more to that than those simple ways of understanding ethos and pathos and logos. Certainly all of those three men that I mentioned are very emotional speakers, but they were not, we would not think of them as primarily swaying with feeling in a negative way. And certainly they all brought a lot of authority and status and position to their work. But again, it was their character more than their position. I mean, they got their positions because of their character, not the other way around in those cases. And again, even their logic, they were using arguments and reason. Well, I'll talk a little bit more about that, how I think logos fits into that in a few minutes. So what I want to do tonight is I want to talk about ethos, pathos, and logos. But I want to talk about each of them as much richer ideas than I think modern rhetoric has made of them, as much fuller and more significant and complicated ideas. And then I want to talk about how I think together those things can help us understand how the very best, and as I'll talk about towards the end, the very worst, you know, the most evil of it, because rhetorical leadership is not always used in the service of good, how rhetorical leaders lead by putting these things together. So I'm certainly not claiming that this is a historical analysis of how Aristotle used these terms, but I am taking him as a jumping off point to say that I think we've emptied those words of their original meanings too much, and we've made them very flat when they're really full, very full. Everybody with me so far? Excellent. I haven't talked about philosophy to a group in a while, so if I'm out of practice. What?
You're doing great.
All right, good. That's good. If I'm out of practice, don't stop me. One of the things that I want to say about this, too, is that we often think about rhetorical leadership as being about persuading, as though a rhetorical leader or a leader who uses language to make change has an idea already fully formed, and then they come into the public space and they put that idea into words. And so what they're trying to do is persuade you of something that they already believe. And one of the things that I think, as I have been thinking about this and doing some of this, is that it really is, that rhetorical use of language is really about the creation of ideas as much as it's about the persuasion. When you look at the very best of the speeches and the writings of, and again, the examples that I'll try and draw from tonight are ones that I think most of us are familiar with, at least some of their writing, King or Lincoln or Churchill, they're working out their ideas in those speeches. They are coming to have ideas and developing those ideas in those speeches. They are not simply already the idea is fully formed over here and now I'm going to try and persuade you of it. The part of the persuasive and rhetorical force is that you're seeing or hearing in those words the working out of very complicated ideas. I also think that we'll see as we look at some examples that those three things, logos and ethos and pathos, are intertwined in those works. They are. It's not as though you can do what a modern rhetoric textbook would do to say, pull out the elements of pathos and list them here. Pull out the places where the speaker uses logic and list those here. They're too intertwined, and Aristotle is looking at sort of pieces of different pieces of a coin rather than three disparate elements. So what do I want to say about these things? I'm going to start with ethos. As I said, ethos is often understood as simply referring to, in a very limited sense, referring to the status or the authority of the speaker, the situation from which the speaker comes. And I want us to think about ethos in a more complicated way, certainly as character in the richest, Greekest sense of that word. But even more specifically, perhaps, in the way that we might learn from object relations psychoanalysis. I'm going to draw a little bit on Christopher Bolas and his work on what it is to be a self. And for Bolas, the self is an idiom. The self is, in a certain sense, a unique language. It's a unique set of meaning experiences that coalesce around certain kinds of objects. And when you think of those great, outstanding rhetorical leaders, they are very significantly very powerful characters. There's a selfhood, a meanness, an I-ness to those people that really stand out as having that gift and that power to lead in that way. They are not, they're very different. I mean, there's not sort of a unique standard or a kind of common standard, but they share a sense of a very fully developed selfhood. Not always an uncomplicated or purely positive one, right? Lincoln maybe suffered from manic depression. Churchill had certain kinds of views and attitudes that might not make him great company over dinner. So these are not necessarily perfect people. They are not necessarily fully moral characters ourselves, but they are fully developed selves. Really with a very unique set of vision and a very rich sense of personal idiom. They are able to translate that personal, those personal passions and idioms into words that match the situations to which they're responding. Bola says, when he talks about the self as idiom, and this is a quote from his book, Forces of Destiny, I never get to quote from things when I'm giving my standard author speech. It's very exciting. He says, I'll read you just a couple brief ones. He says, the unique presence of being that each of us is, a set of unique person possibilities specific to this individual and subject to its articulation of the nature of lived experience in the actual world. He says, here's another way that he puts it. He says, each of us begins life as a peculiar but unrealized idiom of being, a way of being, and in a lifetime transforms that idiom into sensibility and personal reality. Our idiom is an aesthetic. We're going to come back to this, to the art of the sense in which this kind of rhetorical leadership is an art. Our idiom is an aesthetic of being driven by an urge to articulate its theory of form by selecting and using objects so as to give them form. What I want to sort of say in this context then is that rhetorical leadership emerges from the deep, unique self. It is not simply a matter of status. It's not simply a matter of the degrees or the titles that a person holds. Those are really inessential in many ways. Martin Luther King did not hold any fancy titles. I mean, he was a minister and a doctor, but, you know, lots of people had those titles. But it wasn't the titles that gave him his status and stature. Churchill had the title, certainly, but he had that title almost in spite of himself, right? I mean, he came to be the man to lead in that moment, not because he already had been identified as the man to lead, but because he rose to that title. So rather than seeing that sense of ethos as simply sort of those external determiners or those pieces of situation, I would suggest that it's more helpful and more evocative of what you actually see when you look at these examples and exemplars, to think of ethos as a much richer concept, as a concept that includes selfhood and personhood and that sort of ability to really tap into and symbolize those things that are most important to the self. It's not clear to me that Churchill, for example, could have led the civil rights movement in the United States, nor is it clear to me that Martin Luther King could have led Britain in World War II. Each of those men were called in that moment, not only by the circumstances, but by the matching of the circumstances to their own particular passions. There's a certain sense of fit or rightness that has to happen between the selfhood of the leader and the situation that requires leadership in order for that sort of miraculous unfolding of what I'm calling rhetorical leadership to happen. And that comes, I think, as Bolus can help us see it, as object relations psychoanalysis can help us see in general, it comes from an understanding of the way that unique idiom of selfhood is connected to language. The ways in which, as Bolus would say, to fully develop the self is to articulate it, is to put it forward in some sort of symbolic production, words being the most first, but other artworks and other art forms also being the case. And certainly in the exemplars that I chose to sort of represent this phenomenon or this gift, each of them was able to do that. It wasn't just that Lincoln was a particular kind of man, it's that he could express the kind of man he was in his language and in his words. He could identify symbols and objects and tropes that fully express or that brought forward out of his being and into the public sphere who he was. So that sense of self is extremely important. Again, not in a perfected sense. None of these are perfect characters. And I'm picking people that I think we could all agree at least were sort of on the side of good in some general sense. But even they, you know, are not perfect characters or perfect people in any sense. They're human people. And they're deeply human in their uniqueness and their individuality. And they have a gift of being able to put that humanness, that personal humanness, into words and bring it forth from their being, which is again a particular gift. So ethos, I would suggest, we understand more about it if we think of it in this rich sense rather than just as sort of a limited status piece. One last thing about ethos, and then we'll move on to pathos. You see the structure of this talk. The last thing about ethos is that it can't be phony, because you recognize that. You can turn on the TV any day, and you can see a lot of very worked-up talking heads. And many of them, you sense, they would be reading the script in front of them, whoever was filling the paycheck, in other words. That it isn't so much that they have found a cause or are articulating a piece of their being, as it is that, oh, you want me to shill for this particular cause, happy to do it, or I could be selling vacuum cleaners, or I could be shilling for this other cause over here. And you can sense that. You can sense when there's a kind of funny. Now, maybe we can't sense it all together. Maybe some of these people are so gifted at this that they can fool us. But many times you can sense it. And I think one of the pieces of ethos that's so important is that there has to be a kind of an authenticity there. As I said, I don't think that you can just shuffle the men and their causes or their leadership roles and it would all just work out perfectly. There has to be an authentic match there between the man in these cases and the mission. Pathos. Pathos is often really derided. Like, don't be fooled by these plays on emotion or feeling. Try and step back and see the logic. And we sometimes think that a kind of appeal to pathos might even be a fallacy in argument or in persuasion. Again, I want to help us rethink about pathos, not just as sort of feeling, and particularly not just in terms of sort of the pathetic feeling, like pity is usually the example in the rhetoric textbooks. Appeal to pity, that's when I have the poster of the scholarship student. And I have them here with me. But I think the sense of pathos is really, I think we understand that differently when we think about how they use these things. Think about the speeches of Churchill, right? There certainly is a strong emotional quality in those speeches. Have you ever heard the recordings of them in particular? And wouldn't you just do anything to hear Lincoln give those speeches, right? You know that it was a totally different experience. And there is an emotional quality there. But it's not a sort of calculated use of emotion to persuade. The emotions that are appealed to are often joy. They are often delight and vigor. Think about kings. I just was listening to this this morning to sort of get myself riled up for coming here. His last speech, that one where it's very prophetic because he said, he talks about how there have been death threats, and he says, but I am not afraid. You know, I am full of joy. And the emotion in his voice, I want to suggest, has an aesthetic quality. It's the same sort of passion that drives an artwork, and not the sort of false passion that drives the selling of the vacuum cleaner. When you turn, you know, you can certainly turn on your TV and hear somebody getting all worked up about the latest widget, gadget, chopper thing. And you hear excitement, and you hear a certain kind of passion. But when you compare that just on a human responsiveness level to the kind of experience you have when you listen to some of these great rhetorical leaders, you see the emotional quality is, it's not just that it's more vivid, in some cases it's more restrained, but again, there is a kind of transformational quality. You have that sense that what is happening is this person has recognized in him or herself a certain kind of emotive possibility, and again, is bringing that forward into words in the same way an artist does that, a painter or a poet. I think of the way, in this context, I think of the way that haiku writers talk about the haiku moment. This is not the haiku forum, so you may not be that familiar with it, but haiku writers talk about the haiku as emerging from, most specifically, a haiku moment. And it's where you have this incredible sense of event or experience in the now, in the present. I'm feeling this, I'm noticing it, I'm experiencing it right now as I'm speaking to you. Even if this is a speech that I wrote yesterday, I'm feeling it now, and I pull it forward into an articulation for you and for me too, because it's the only way I can see it fully. And in the same way that there's an aesthetic to that, I think we see that in that relationship of pathos. It's immediate, it's expressed simply. Those great rhetorical leaders, they're not in all sorts of flighty, there are fewer adjectives in Martin Luther King's speech than there are in the infomercial. They're not emotive in that way. They are not pathetic in the way the infomercial often is on some level. There's a kind of a purity there. I think I'll maybe save that quote because I don't want to go on about that too long, but we can get back to that. Let me say some things about logos. Logos, again, is often logic, as though the sort of purest or best form that a persuasion or a persuasive leader, a rhetorical leader can take is sort of cold, hard logic. Let me give you the facts and just the facts. And I would suggest that, again, when you look at these exemplars, you see that they are not giving you facts. They are, in a certain sense, making facts. And they're making facts by making concepts. They're making concepts in, I see a Galician in the room, in a plane of imminence, right? They are creating a worldview. They're creating a way of thinking in which certain concepts make sense and certain facts follow from those concepts. And I'm not trying to say that there's a total relativism here. That's not what I'm suggesting, as though the facts could be anything. But the way of articulating the facts to themselves makes a difference. Deleuze, Gilles Deleuze, a French post-structuralist thinker, died in 1995. I brought my footnote here with me, died in 1995. He, in his book, What is Philosophy, talked about that the role of philosophy is to create concepts. The philosopher is the friend of the concept, which you just have to, it sounds even better in French. But for Deleuze, it's that creation, that creative work of making the concept that is the power of the thinker. And so he says, concepts always are signed. They're never just free-floating. And so he talks about, for example, Plato's forms, or Descartes' cogito, or Aristotle's ethics, that the idea goes along with the thinker. And again, you can see this at work in these exemplars, right? So Churchill is not just saying some stuff about Britain, he's inventing Britain. He's inventing our island in his speaking. Lincoln is inventing the Union, reinventing the Union in his speeches. We were just talking about that example. He's creating a concept out of which certain ideas flow. Once you buy into or understand or get Lincoln's vision of the Union and its relationship to the Constitution and to God and to all of these other things, a whole set of things follow from that. It follows, for example, that as president, his sworn duty is to preserve the Union. It follows that those who would seek to disrupt the Union are traitors to the whole system of government and to the Constitution rather than followers. It follows that, all of these sorts of things. Something is beeping, and I don't know what it is. Oh, good. Thank you. Is that a signal for something? Did I? Okay. Let's check. He's creating that idea. Martin Luther King is creating a new conception of equality. His vision of equality is very different than what came before. It's very different than what is articulated in the Declaration of Independence, for example. It's a very unique vision of equality in which, again, it's, you know, for him, it's not just about structural inequality, not just about legal inequalities, it's about structural inequalities. And he's creating that idea. He's, in many ways, inventing a new vision of human personhood that transcends race. So it isn't, I would suggest, simply that there are sort of these premises, and a rhetorical leader's job is to draw a conclusion from those premises. A rhetorical leader is creating concepts as he or she goes along, and is giving us new ways to think. And out of those new ways come new ideas, which again is very different, I think, than the very narrow sense of logos. I'm looking at logos much more in the sort of Greek sense of the word, the concept, the idea with the capital I. And each of these exemplars certainly did that. Once a concept is formed, when it has the richness, really, of concept, and it really unfolds in a plane of immanence, it will take on a life of its own. And so we debate, we change, we argue about those concepts. But part of their greatness, the greatness of these thinkers and these leaders, is that they created these visions of who and what we were. When you hear Churchill talk about victory for Britain, this island he's over there. This island, right? I'm not sure Britain thought of itself as an island before that. I mean, but think of all that goes along with that as a concept in that sense. I mean, it was there. It hails to sort of Celtic mythology, and yet it also talks about this sort of separateness that, I mean, the whole thing, it's genius. And it is genius. So I've talked about, and I've tried to sort of lay out how I think Aristotle has something really important to show us about rhetorical leadership, but only if we think of these three pieces in a more robust fashion. I want to now just turn very briefly to another question, and then we can have some discussion. And that is this. My examples, as I said, I tried to pick people that are we would tend to agree were forces for good. I didn't try to pick controversial people. And yet, we also are aware that there are people with this sort of gift for rhetorical leadership who do not use it in the service of good. Okay? I could have been quoting from Hitler's speeches. Hitler certainly was a very unique character, certainly was able to find articulations for that character in his language. I didn't quote from him just because I feel like that it's evil to even quote from him. You know, we don't need to hear his words. He certainly invented new concepts. He certainly, you know, the concept of the Aryan, Hitler's concept of the Aryan is the invention of a new concept. So I think the question, too, is not only how do you find a match for the situation and the leader and that those gifts and that skill, and how does the leader develop in him or herself this sort of emotional vulnerability to unfold him or herself in the service of this public good, but also how do we support and recognize when this very powerful skill is being used in the service of good, and how do we fight against it when this very powerful skill is being used in the service of evil? How do we even recognize it? Because we are very vulnerable to the persuasions of rhetoric, not necessarily to the sort of thinned out persuasions of rhetoric as we understand. You know, we're very sophisticated about advertising, at least many of its forms. We can sort of distance ourselves from that. It's much harder to be distancing yourself from what Churchill is saying when you are listening on the radio in your blacked out window during the Blitz, right? Or when you are a German, well, I won't even go into those examples, but it's harder, right? That's harder. So how do we do that? Is it possible? Can we do it? How do we recognize it? And how do we know? I want to say something very brief about this, and then I'm very interested in the kinds of things you all have to say about this. I think there is something in the sense that rhetorical force in the service of good is responsive and responds. It recognizes alternative possibilities and alternative ways of understanding, and it is able to respond to them and be responsive. It doesn't feel the need to shut out all other alternative ways of thinking. Lincoln, again, is a very good example. Lincoln certainly recognized alternative perspectives. He talks about them all the time in his speeches. He participated in debates and would speak before audiences that were not automatically in agreement. He could tolerate criticism without it destroying the force of his own argument. You could witness the change of mind. Right? Churchill had a harder time. I mean, Churchill, it's not clear that he could have adapted to leadership after the war. He was not necessarily, and I think the British people realized, right? He's not really going to be able to have a conversation about what's next for the empire. Because for him, the empire was so sacrosanct in his way of thinking. And his ability to lead for good, at least in the minds of the British people at that time, came to an end at the end of the war. We don't know what has become of it. I mean, you know, one of the things about some of these leaders is they're very powerful. They often die prematurely. And so we don't know the degree or the extent to which you can remain a force of good, which means remaining in process, remaining able to create new articulations, to have new concepts emerge out of oneself, the extent to which a leader can remain flexible to this. But I do think there's something in that notion of flexibility and in responsiveness that is at least some part of the marker that separates sort of the good from the evil. And I think I will just stop there and let's have some conversation.
Thank you. David, for Dr. Haas? Questions? I'd like to ask you to keep your questions very succinct.
I Socrates School at Athens trained as a resource to argue one side or the other, and sometimes the same resource would argue one side of the case and the next day argue the other side opposite. The other philosophers, Aristotle included, said, you know, it's very cynical that you can change logic around, you know, just to sway your audience. And history is replete with people who do that. Hitler, Pope Urban that preached the Crusades, that it's not necessarily the logic of the argument, but the pathos,
right.
the the emotion of it. Evangelists that could preach good and some that could preach very, very bad bigotry. Mm-hmm. So how are we, as the listeners, to discern, you know, to divide the pathos from the logos?
No, I think that's right. And even the pathos from the pathos, because I do think there's a difference between, I want to make a couple different distinctions, I think, that might help. I don't know that they'll answer your question. It might help at least separate out some of the threads of the question. On the one hand, there's the question of sort of the lawyer, right, where here's your case, here's your brief, you argue against for against this. And we're having some public debate right now about whether or not that's ethical in every case, or whether there are some sides that shouldn't even be argued, right? So we tend to think in this country that there is a value to having all of the sides of the case presented as fairly as possible. We tend to think that that's a good. And I would suggest that there is a good to that. So training people to be effective at doing that is sort of one set of questions. Is that an inherently good thing to do or an inherently bad thing to do? Are you training people in the art of deception and dissimulation if you train them to do that? Hitler, I think, is a different case. I don't think Hitler would have been just as happy arguing either side, right? That's not the source of his problem. He is passionate about his side, and he is creating concepts. And I think it's going to be more complicated than just separating out ethos and pathos and logos, because the logos on the side of good is not the sort of pro forma argument either. It's not that there aren't good reasons, but those reasons are embedded in a way of thinking that to even understand them as reasons, you have to partially take up. You have to have a certain kind of sympathy. King has to be able not to persuade you in the sense of just a cold, hard syllogism. King has to make you feel the his own humanity. He is a human being standing before you. And once he's accomplished that, a lot of the rest of it follows, but he's not accomplishing that through the syllogism. So if we say to ourselves, the way we'll distinguish the good from the evil is we'll take all the pathos out and we'll just look at the logos and the syllogism, I don't think that's going to do it for us. I don't think that's going to really be how we're going to do that. I think if we do that, we won't have the good either. So it is very complicated.
This gentleman here, and then this gentleman in the back.
Ted Tversky. You return to Aristotle, of course, who said nobody does evil knowingly.
Right.
But I wish you would go on with because I think some of these ideas could be developed further. For one thing, you're talking about how the evil doesn't want to hear the other side. That's what Popper said too, that closed societies. You know, you grab everybody by the throat and get your way, and if you can't eliminate an idea by persuading people that it's false, then you tell them. And that was kind of where Hitler ultimately wound up going. And then just to continue Popperian analysis, this is all world too, that I believe is how he would characterize it, and where these world historical figures are struggling to set the landscape and the landmarks in this world too. Where are we at now with these kinds of things?
Well, and this is a good question, right? You'll notice I also didn't put on my list of exemplars any of our contemporary figures, right? We can do that because many people say Obama has this gift. There are people who say Sarah Palin has this gift. How do we know in our own context, right? How do we know? And if Obama does have this gift, it's got to be more, right, than just that he can be a fully developed self in the public sphere. Right? I think that is one of his gifts. He can be himself in the public sphere. He has that sense of ethos that's very apparent. Can he have the logos? Can he develop concepts that are rich enough that they will lead us forward? Right?
Or wherever we're going.
I mean, lead us for good in some sense, right? We want a leader that can do that. I mean, whatever your politics, you want a leader that can lead us towards the good. But whether or not he will be able to do that, can he capture the zeitgeist? Can he be that person and express it fully, not just in the campaign, but in the leadership of the country? It's very hard to tell when you're this close to it, right? It certainly was not apparent, you know, during Lincoln's time that he was even going to get elected, much less that he was going to be able to hold the union together. It certainly wasn't apparent that King was going to be able to affect real change. You know, so it's very hard to tell these things in the present. It's very hard.
Okay, so gentleman in the back, and then Jeff.
In the United Kingdom, the barrister and now some other attorneys take either side.
Right.
They're called upon to represent the state, and then they may, the following week, be called upon to represent the defendant in a similar crime involving violation of the same statute. They have to have this ability to convince people that they have the stature to present the case, mm-hmm. and then have the emotion in it, and then the logic. And they do it mm-hmm. remarkably well. I think it's a lesson for attorneys in the United States. The other thing I would mention, I think toward the end, you said something about following the leader and the leader having room for the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln having room for the other side. Churchill, not so much. Martin Luther King had an open mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I have to think, and I have to mention the name, and we'll drop it then, George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
There was no room for the other side. It was his way, and he was very persuasive with a certain element of the population. So when someone says, how do you recognize and how do you sift? Well, one thing from having had experience with graduates of your school is you send your children to Austin College.
You have the gift of rhetorical leadership. And as a brand new Texan, I'm not going to comment on local politics.
I remember this, charming man.
Charming is a big part of it.
I'm going to give you my card.
Good.
And ask that you and I get together.
Wonderful. Well, I would love to hear about this.
Jack, and then John.
Can you take him? Lots of college people are very passionate about it.
Actually, I kind of like to make a comment, see if you have thoughts about it. But I think it's interesting, and I agree with your statement about the timing of a personality in the context of history, because at the same time that you know, Churchill was being an effective leader in World War II, right after World War II, the empire dissolved, basically.
Yeah.
And for instance, India, you know, had been part of the empire for 300 years,
right.
And there was this point of view from the British point of view that the natives were better off being led by civilized, more sophisticated governance than they were on their own, although they never for 300 years accepted that.
Mm-hmm.
And at about the same time that Churchill was being an effective leader in his own way, Gandhi appeared.
Right.
And, you know, they overcame this, right, and it culminated just at the right time, but they had several failures in their rebellion, if you will, mm-hmm. against the empire until Gandhi and this point in time. So
right.
I just wondered if you had any other
thoughts. No, it's a perfect example. And you think, you know, what might have hit, Churchill's legacy after the war been if he could have captured what was becoming the British zeitgeist and that recognition that the whole concept of empire, that the plane of imminence in which the concept of empire made sense had dissolved in part of World War. You know, what could he have been if he had recognized that? The Gandhi is a great example because it allows me to clarify something, which is that rhetorical leaders may not be using words. We don't necessarily, I mean, Gandhi certainly used words, but his words were his actions, right? That power of showing up in the loincloth with the salt, those were words. I mean, that's rhetorical leadership, but he's using actions and rather than what we would think of as giving speeches in that way.
John?
Addressing the question, how shall I judge? What criteria shall I use?
Mm-hmm.
Would it be fair to say that there is that in us which recognizes authenticity. Mm-hmm. And in what we're recognizing in great leaders, we are in a sense ultimately the judge here. But
right.
If we are right, we'll make the right choices.
Right.
If we'll listen to the right voices. So
right.
The assumption that these for these rhetorical leaders for the good have articulated at a higher synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
It's an apotheosis.
Right. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Yeah.
And looking at it from the perspective of the jury system is based on the assumption that truth has clout.
Mm-hmm.
That it doesn't always clobber.
Right.
Unfortunately, but
right.
It's based on the assumption that truth in itself has clout. And there's a notion in aesthetics of cognition.
Yeah, and can we
that we
feel
recognize
it? Yeah.
That there is that and yeah. part of our humanity that
yeah.
recognizes this is more authentic than that.
And that might be a really good helpful idea because I do think there's a piece of it that has to do with authenticity, that is sort of what separates the lawyers or the, you know, arguing on either side from the question of sort of Hitler versus Churchill or, you know, versus Martin Luther King. Hitler was authentic. I think people certainly recognize authenticity in what he was saying. It came from deep inside him. It's just what was inside him was so twisted. So there has to be, we have to have some ability to step back and not only be swayed by authenticity. The passion of the person and the realness the concepts and the idea have for that person can't be our only guide. We have to be able to compare that to something, or we're likely to be swayed by evil leaders. But what that something is, but I do think there is something, you're right about something that we can sense authenticity. Now, you might say in the case of the lawyers, well, not really, because they can go, but over time and in complicated situations, and when you see them in multiple situations, it's harder to keep that pretense up. You know, the evil thing about Hitler was he was so authentic. You know, if he was really just after land or power or money or something, you feel you could understand, but he, for him, these were real.
But I guess I'm going to use the word authentic and the long shot view of history.
Right, right.
Great books left.
Right, right.
It's not trash.
Yeah.
Less.
Yeah, that's interesting.
However it may appeal to a particular time and place. Right,
great. It seems to me that the nearest thing we can come to an answer on how to decide, you proposed that question earlier, would be to hear from various sides, because each side that divides all three of these factors that you have is going to be a specialist in their own thing.
Yeah.
And they're going to have an advantage over the average person who doesn't have time or interest to specialize in their own thing. You pick out all the flaws and all the disjoints.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you listen to someone that's hopefully equally adept at presenting a different side,
mm-hmm.
and that's the best way that we can do.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have time to make a lifetime mm-hmm. of study
yeah.
that particular thing.
That's interesting. And we also see how they behave as well. We do see them under circumstances. We see the extent to which they're willing to risk. All three of the exemplars I gave put themselves at great personal risk in ways that other people don't.
Ms. John Becker?
Lincoln wrote his own speeches. Churchill wrote his own speeches. I think Martin Luther King did too. Today, they create music and language. Do you think the technologies like Twitter, blogs, and so forth are making us tone deaf?
That's a very good question. When you think about the days when rhetoric was taught in school, and you'd have to do you ever have to memorize anything and recite it? No, I mean, that's not, right? You don't have to do that in school. That's not, I mean, we don't tend to think about the power of the spoken word very much. Now, maybe Twitter and blogs give us more access to the written word, although it's not necessarily in those sorts of persuasive ways. I'm very interested in the sense of the power and the immediacy of the spoken word. You know, obviously Churchill made a lot, you know, the radio and you know, as I said, wouldn't you love to just hear Lincoln giving these speeches, if that is possible?
Like Obama without the
right, without
the...
Right,
without the...
Right, right. Right, and that's it. So, you know, to what extent is what happened? Well, part of it, maybe this is another way of saying it. We don't, this is a really unique forum because you get to see people thinking and speaking at the same time. And we don't have a lot of room for that in our public forum. We don't have a lot of tolerance for it. You know, imagine if during one of these political debates, one of the candidates turned to the other and said, you know, that's a really interesting point. You know what that makes me think about? You know, da-da-da-da-da. I mean, we would have, you know, flip-flopping, whatever, da-da-da-da. So there's a certain sense in which our political arena for conversation and sort of most of the world of ideas of conversation, we've wanted to denude it of any actual thinking in the present. You can have thought off camera. You can come in and say, well, I used to think this, and now I think this, although even that you better be careful about. But to actually change your mind visibly in front of people publicly, or even to acknowledge that you have thought hard about an opposing idea, we just don't tolerate that. And that might be a difference, you know. Yeah, right. You know, there's no space for that. Now, maybe the internet, maybe that's happening on the internet. I mean, there's debate on the internet. I defer to the young people in the blogging.
This gentleman right here.
I'm kind of still pondering this idea of how you would decide, say, between two orators, if you put it that way, a value system, let's say. And I was thinking of an aphorism that every lie has a core of truth to it, which makes it that much more difficult because I think part of it is that any great orator, whether you want to label them good, bad, or whatever, has to hook into the value system of the people, his audience. And of course, that changes over time and changes over culture and all that stuff, at least to some degree. I'm not trying to be completely relativistic, but there is some. And so... I just want to throw out that that's part of the problem in trying to make that standard because, you know, you can say, well, Hitler's so bad, but he was hooking into the fears, the concerns, you know, the anger of the people that he was addressing his speeches to.
And that notion of fear is something I've been thinking a lot about as well. You know, is that sort of part of what's on the side of good versus evil, the extent to which that... In that realm of pathos, what you're articulating is fear. Is that a more dangerous kind of articulation, even if it's authentic, than articulations that appeal to sort of higher order sensibilities, like justice, say, or fairness? So that's very, very interesting. Another thing that what you were saying makes me think about is... we tend to sort of think of the debate like Martin Luther King versus, you know, some racist point of view. But for a lot of people, certainly for a lot of Black Americans, it was Martin Luther King versus Malcolm X, right? And that sort of sense of who is better articulating me in this? Who is better putting into words who and what we are and what we need to become? That could be a fascinating study of how those words, as in that time, were being heard and adjudicated by people of different ages and in, you know, city versus country life. Because I think for many Black Americans, that was really, you know, that was sort of the debate for the hearts and minds. Were two very different visions. I mean, many historians now would say, if you really look closely, they were a lot more together on certain issues than not. But you know, that was sort of the vision.
That was later when Malcolm.
Right. Agreed. Right. Okay, but King got more radical, too.
We'll get to you in just a second. We got Jack, Bob, this young lady here, this lady in the back, and then Lawrence. And then we're probably going to run out of time.
Okay, that's good.
So, Jack.
I'll give up my time to Bob.
All right, Bob. Thank you, Jack.
Well, saying about Churchill said it was the empire. He has a whole lot of books writing about the empire.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was one of the things that works.
Yeah.
You got that? Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah, that would have been a good example, too.
You know, he would get on those firesides. See, I'm so old, I actually heard these guys.
Yeah.
On the radio. I don't have to worry about it.
Tell the young people what a radio is.
You too. Yeah. He makes your pets.
Yeah.
Welcome to locals.
Yeah.
It was like a nightclub.
Yeah.
What I'm really interested in your opinion, now, Plato or Socrates, or at least Socrates, you know, I say Socrates through the voice of Plato.
Sure.
Hold it against her.
Right.
You know, he considered it not knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
He made a big distinction. The knowledge of somebody
else. Yes.
And his big protagonist was Thrasymachus, you know, the rhetoricians were a scorn to the earth,
right.
The Socrates and the Plato. And Aristotle, who was his student, writes a book on rhetoric and promotes it. But generally right, the lawyers,
right.
The business people of that day, just like today, were the rhetoricians,
right.
The public figures.
Right.
And so I wonder how do you think that Aristotle, who they were both aristocrats, you know, and Plato, how he got away from the Socratic
view
of this looking down upon I don't know what word to use, but you know,
comment on the historical question or the, you know, the classical question of what that really came to. But I think you're certainly pointing to that same sort of issue. We have this suspicion of the use of language to artificially argue points of view. We recognize it can be necessary. And one of the things that we recognize in our law courts is that people have a role to play, right? It's not as though the jury sits there and somebody comes in and says, well, I'm a neutral party and here's what you should think, right? The person comes in and says, I represent the defense and here's that perspective. So we do believe that we want that articulated, but we're suspicious of that. We want, in the people that we're following as leaders, we want that sense of authenticity. And we hope we can recognize that, I don't know what I'm stepping on. We hope we can recognize it when we see it, whether we can.
See, I call it propaganda.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
What I want to say.
Well, and it may be. And it may be, but...
And it uses informal logic, not formal logic.
Yes, it does. But by that sense, Lincoln was a propagandist, and so was Churchill, and so was Roosevelt. And so, you know, it's not as though we're going to be able to use that to sort of just separate the leaders who lead towards good from the leaders who lead towards bad.
Okay, this lady here, and then Lawrence, and then the lady in the back, and then we'll be right out of time.
So, one thing that comes up for me is the word congruence.
Mm.
And as you're talking about this, I was thinking, so, you know, it's an expression we use about people having, you know, some having skin in the game.
Mm-hmm.
The difference with a barrister's love may be the process of law, that this has to happen, or that each side is presented, as opposed to the particular case that he's arguing. The leaders you're talking about seem to be taking risk, and risking really everything, risking everything
right.
That matters. Authenticity doesn't feel like a big enough word. Mm-hmm. There's a, mm-hmm. this congruence between what they do and what they say.
Yeah.
Obama sounded, could deliver a speech on race the way he did because of white roots and black roots.
Mm-hmm.
That a completely black man or a completely white man.
Someone with no experience in those two worlds. Right. Right. It came out of his lived experience.
The other thing I wanted to say connected to this that we haven't mentioned is I wonder if the defining that difference is that the rhetoric creates something new.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
well,
right.
Part of Mr. King and Malcolm X had was something new.
Absolutely.
There were different articulations of how black people could be in America at that time.
That's your question.
And so, well, my that's
fascinating.
Is it the knob? Is what you're looking for that makes a leader, makes the kind of leadership that a leader's ability to transcend not just circumstance, but our thinking,
right.
to create something new in our thinking.
I do think that's very crucial, and I was talking about that under the sign of logos as this creation of the new concept. And concept maybe sounds so cerebral, and small, but I was thinking of it in this Deleuzian sense where it's a new framework. And I would say, you know, the other examples too, Churchill, he's creating the valiant Briton who stands up and pursues victory in the darkest hour as he's speaking it. And people hear and say, yes, that's who we are.
But that's different than the lawyer to me arguing a case.
Yes.
No matter how.
Yeah, very different. Agreed.
Okay, thank you. Lawrence.
My question is very, as we're speaking, my mind went back to the pre-Socratic era, for example.
Yeah.
And all the true time, like during the Lyceum and the School of Athens. And one of the major reasons why Aristotle, for example, tried to bring about this concept was also for the purpose of pursuing the truth.
Mm-hmm.
See, and that is where I'm really thinking. See, even though I say he was so preoccupied with trying to find answers for so many things. So how do we, in today's modern lifestyle, connecting back to Aristotle, how do we see the same dynamics that he used to create his concepts in our life today? How do we, just like the question, you know, that the gentleman asked, you know, I'm trying to say, how can we restill? It really bothers my mind. Because that is what I think. I realized the main intention was to help people to pursue the truth, the ultimate truth.
And it is a kind, it requires that kind of passion, right? I mean, you know, it's an obsession almost. You know, these kinds of leaders are not necessarily great family men. They're not, you know, there's an exceptional quality because it's the articulation of the self that can't let go of this question. You know, I didn't also, I thought about using some biblical examples, too, of people that had this sort of quality. Like, Moses did not have this, right? He needed his brother to come in and do this. David probably had it, you know? But is it that call from God? Is it, you know, in some sense of that word, that there's a calling to be this kind of leader, and that congruence of situation and man, it doesn't let you go. You know, King, they could put him in jail, they could do whatever they were going to do, he was still going to continue to think these thoughts. Whether he had, if he was preaching to the stones and the birds, he was going to be making these thoughts because he had to figure it out. What is it that makes me a man? What is it that makes the need for the recognition of my selfhood and your selfhood and the selfhood of our brothers and sisters so, you know, what is that? He could not let that go. And the same thing, you know, with the other examples.
All right, quick. Last question.
The connection to the quest.
Yes.
Is so important. I think that's what makes it a good cause.
Mm-hmm.
Most people are there. It's not to be religion of the world. Alice in Wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
And in the world of the Red Queen, is it better to rule by fear or love?
Yeah.
Was hers.
Yeah.
And then the White Queen says that I cannot take a life, but I need a champion to fight for me.
Oh, interesting.
So Alice has a choice that she realizes she has a choice here, and that is to be the champion.
Mm-hmm.
That will take the road.
Right. There, you know, and if you think about that sort of, and on sort of the most base human level, we all have fears, right? And it is relatively easy to lose ourselves in those fears and to speak the pathos of the fear. It takes a certain kind of character to rise above that and speak to our higher emotions. And so there is something remarkable about leaders who are able to do that. Particularly if it's coupled with their ability to really generate those powerful, transformative, life-changing concepts. Those leaders are few and far between. If we were going to have part two of this lecture, we would talk about what sorts of structures, educationally, politically, culturally, might foster that kind of leadership, and what totally inhibits it. So thank you all so much.
I also want to thank her husband, Dr. Larry Haas. He's a philosophy professor at Austin College. I said it right this time. Austin College as well. And a magician as well. And son, Cameron, he's studying political science at what college is that?
Muhlenberg College.
Yeah. So anyway, we thank you all for coming. It was a delightful speech. And I want to remind you that in 2 weeks we have Dr. Robert Figueroa, the UNT Philosophy Department. He'll be speaking on environmental justice and the ethical crisis of climate change.